Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. I'm Daniel Emery Price, joined by Eric Sorensen. Hey, CHF Detroit is in the books. It was a good time. There's going to be talks being leaked out very soon. You should check those out. We're not here for that, but we just want you to know that if you weren't there, shame on you, and we had a good time.
Shame on you. Now getting to the gospel.
Yeah, because we're all about shaming people.
Yeah. It was a good time though. I mean, I had a blast out there. It was short. I mean, man, I had an 8-hour flight delay out to Detroit, so my time there felt like extremely compressed. But the time we did have, it was awesome. I had a Coney dog. I actually had two of them. So I got what I was looking for, and we had a great time, and the conference was awesome. Great music, great presenters. Everyone, I think, just knocked it out of the park. It was really a great time.
Yeah, and if you were going to go, if you were in Detroit and you say you wanted to go somewhere for a hang, I think we found the best place that you can possibly go.
Yeah, there's this place called Green Dot Stables in Detroit. Oh my goodness, the sliders there were incredible. I had way too many, way too many, and I don't regret it.
Yeah, that's it. It was a good place. If you're looking for, like, hey, you gotta have, go get some beef and some drinks, there you go. That's the place to do it. The place was incredible. Okay, on to the passage. We left off in Matthew chapter 9.
We're at verse 32.
Mm.
And it reads like this: as they were going away, behold, a demon-oppressed man who was mute was brought to him. Now, him here, of course, is Jesus. And when the demon had been cast out, the mute man spoke, and the crowds marveled, saying, never was anything like this seen in Israel. But the Pharisees said, he casts out demons by the prince of demons. So what we're seeing here in this passage is not unusual for this chapter. Before this this healing of the mute man, you see Jesus heal two blind men. You see him before that restore a girl to life and heal a woman. And this is not unusual for the life of Jesus. But there is something in this passage that I feel like is worthy of at least some discussion. And that's the whole issue of demon possession, because this passage very clearly says that the reason this man was mute is because a demon had oppressed him. So, I think a question that sometimes can come to us is, especially in America, is why does it seem that we don't see the kind of demonic activity that the New Testament seems to show happening fairly often?
Well, I think one of the reasons is that Jesus is able to identify demon possession easily. He knows it. Not the case with us, you know.
Correct.
So Jesus knows what a thing is. We don't necessarily know that. And so when the writers of the Gospels are like recounting the deeds of Jesus, and if they brought a man to him, now they might not know when they bring this man to him at first that this man is demon possessed. They just know he's mute. But then if Jesus then casts a demon out of him, when they recount the story, they're going to say, well, there's this demon possessed guy who is mute. We know that because Jesus cast a demon out of him. Now, would you or I think that that man was demon possessed? I don't know.
Yeah.
But there's probably a good chance we wouldn't. And so I think that's part of it, is that the Bible is able to tell you, I mean, the recounting of the life of Jesus is able to tell you what he says these things are,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't possess the same ability to know, we don't know those things. And so I don't think that, so sometimes demon possession in the Bible looks like really crazy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We saw that, the guy who's living in the tombs and stuff like that. Now, if we saw that now, we might say, is that guy demon-possessed? What the heck? We might say that.
Right.
That's pretty crazy. But if we saw someone who was mute, and this is in no way saying that all mute people are demon-possessed. That's not at all what I'm saying or the text is saying. But I don't know that you would assume that's the case. And so
so
I think that's part of it. It's just like Jesus knows when that is the case.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think You know, I mean, there's places, some of this depends on the tradition you come from too, right? I mean, if you're in some churches, they really do kind of over-diagnose the demon thing so that like everything is demonic.
Everything.
Like every problem in the world, you've got a demon of this, you've got a spirit of this, you've got, you know, and we see that the results of the over-diagnosis is basically, you know, that sometimes when it's taken to the extreme, that people, you know, won't go to a hospital or won't seek medical care because, hey, it's just all spiritual. Well, no, that's not the case. And like you said, Dan, we don't have the same perception that Jesus does. And so at best in my life, I can think of maybe a couple of experiences that have led me to wonder if I am dealing with somebody that might have this issue, that might be demon possessed. You know, my wife worked in a mental hospital for years as a nurse, and 99% of the cases that she dealt with, you know, it was basically an issue of medication. And when somebody would get the right medication, they would be calmed down and brought back to a right state of mind. But then there were times where it seemed that nothing would work, and we were sort of left to wonder, well, maybe this is that. Also, another possibility, and this is just, I mean, we're sort of conjecturing right now, but another possibility is, you know, this is God in the flesh. And when God in the flesh comes, and so too when God is spreading his church in the book of Acts, and you see this kind of demonic activity, it makes sense. I mean, it makes sense that you would see, you know, all-out war happening, all-out, you know, because Jesus is casting them out everywhere and doing things like throwing them into a herd of pigs and sending them off a cliff, you know. So, you know, there is theories like that that exist. Ultimately, we don't know exactly why, but I think those are at least reasonable ways to deal with the question.
Well, I mean, think about this. When you read the Old Testament, you don't read like story after story after story of demon possession. And when you read the epistles, you don't see Paul or Peter or John talking about like all the demon possession that they're dealing with.
Right.
Or how we're supposed to deal with it. But this is really like it's unique. This is unique to the Gospels in a lot of ways. There's a little bit in Acts.
Yeah, and to some extent the book of Acts, yeah.
A little bit in Acts. But yeah, so I mean it's right here in the text, but it says never was anything like this seen in Israel.
Right.
And so I think all of a sudden you have God in the flesh on the scene, and he's like dealing with demonic things that they didn't talk about in the Old Testament. It wasn't like, you know, there's a story about David being confronted by some demon-possessed guy, or, you know, Samuel, or, you know, the prophet Isaiah or something like that. And then he's like, oh, this guy's got a demon. I get, you know, it wasn't like Elijah went to do battle with the prophets of Baal and then cast demons out of all of them or something like that. That's not something we see happening. That's sort of unique to Christ and the apostles.
Yeah. Right.
And so I think that you should remember that as we live our lives and know that this is not something that we're not instructed like, in the epistles on like, you know, make sure you get rid of all the demons that are out there. We know that's a big problem. There's not a lot of that showing up. And so I do think that this is sort of Jesus dealing with the devil, and we see it, and we should understand it that way. And that's why it was never seen like that. Nothing like that had ever been seen in Israel, because God in the flesh had never been seen in Israel.
Yeah. I think that's a reasonable way of kind of handling that. And I think it's a biblically consistent way of seeing that issue. There's another issue that comes up in this text. I mean, besides the marvelous healing of a man who couldn't speak, you do hear at the end the Pharisees saying he casts out demons by the prince of demons. And that is an indictment of them.
Yes.
Remember, this is what got them into trouble. When Jesus talks about the blasphemy and the Holy Spirit or the unforgivable sin, It's really on the heels of the Pharisees making such statements, attributing the power of God that Jesus is displaying to the power of the devil.
Which is just unbelief on 11.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's what when you're talking about the unforgivable sin, you're talking about like dying in unbelief.
Right.
Dying out of faith. But like, you don't get any more unbelieving than when the Son of God is performing miracles right in front of your physical eyeballs, and you're like, that's satanic, dude.
Right.
That's just like a heart that is just calloused over. You are like, God is like giving you the actual evidence of his power, and you're just like, that seems satanic.
This is one of the reasons, Dan, that like when people say to me, if I could just see God do a miracle in front of me, or if he just reveal himself to me, then I'd believe. I can always say with just about 100% certainty, no, you wouldn't.
No, you wouldn't. Of course not.
I mean, Jesus says the same thing. He's like, listen, you know, when the rich man and Lazarus in that parable, and Lazarus is, you know, just in agony after he's died and he's gone to the place of torment, and he says, send somebody to warn my brothers about this. And, you know, Jesus essentially says, well, they've got Moses and the prophets. They've got the word of God. And that's enough. You know, the reality is the nation of Israel's whole history so often was there were these miraculous things God did. And it didn't stop them from, you know, worshiping a golden calf within a matter of minutes.
Right. I mean, like, this is what God says to him. If they do not believe Moses and the prophets, neither will they believe if someone rises from the dead. Speaking not of just sending Lazarus back from the dead, but speaking of the resurrection of Christ as well. Because what do the Pharisees do when the guy goes back and be like, yeah, he's gone. Angel showed up, like, stone rolled away. They're like, here's some money. Tell him someone stole him.
Right, right.
Epic unbelief, dude. Like, I mean, like...
Yeah, this is why conversion has to be a miracle of God's work. It has to be the Spirit's work, because we are so dead in trespasses and sins that we'll find a way to deny Jesus. We'll find a way to deny him, no matter what, unless the Spirit does his regenerating work.
That's it. Yeah, faith is a gift.
Oh, yes, it is, and amen for that. I'd be lost without it. So from Jesus healing the mute man and being accused of casting out demons by the prince of demons, we move on to verse 35. And Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and affliction and every affliction.
Paul, I just want to reiterate a point that we made last week about this like wake of healing kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because what's going to happen here is we're going to get into another thing. I don't want us to get lost in the shuffle here. So he's teaching in the synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, that is the reign of Christ, mm-hmm. and healing every disease and every affliction. So like in his temporary reign, sort of here in the flesh, you see this wake of healing, and he's like restoring everything that he comes into contact with. So you see that the gospel of the kingdom is redemption, reconciliation.
Yeah, restoration.
Yeah, right? And that's what all of that's about. So as he's proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, like everything is being made whole.
Yes. That's the end game.
Right, which is a preview of like the ultimate thing that's going to happen at the end of all this.
That's exactly right. And again, you see that tandem, again, of proclaiming and action. So it's not one or the other. You know, we've talked about this a lot going through Matthew, that it's both and proclamation and deeds. Mm-hmm. And so we go to verse 36. When Jesus saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Now, I got to say, Dan, this is one of my – I love this verse. I've focused on it so much. It's been one of those verses that – has this verse and the next verse following, which I'll read in a second, it's been one of those verses that's inspired me to think about what it means to be a pastor or to be a shepherd of souls, as pastors are called to be. And, you know, first you see, of course, Jesus has compassion for them. This is repeated throughout Matthew's gospel. Jesus's compassion, that the word meaning like a shared sense of suffering. Like God does not stay far away from the agony of our plight and our difficulties in life, but he actually feels it with us. Like he shares in that suffering. And the reason the text says he does is because it says they were harassed. The crowds were harassed and helpless. Now, there's something really, really important about those two words that I think kind of get overlooked in the translation from Greek to English. The word for harassed can literally be translated flayed open or slashed open. And the word for helpless is the word for thrown down or cast aside. So when you read those two words with that understanding, and then you read that they look to him like sheep without a shepherd, what it's actually being said is Jesus looks over the world and sees them like sheep that have been attacked by wolves. Wolves that have come in, torn apart the sheep, and then cast them down. Jesus sees the world like that and has an incredible amount of compassion for them.
Yeah, I mean, and I think in this instance too, because he's, I mean, when we get to Matthew 23, we'll see exactly who he thinks are some of the primary harassers and throwdowners of them. I mean, he is talking about the crowds, and he felt compassion because the Pharisees had just shredded up the people with more law than they can possibly ever do. And left them helpless, right? I mean, like, this is what Jesus says, like, you tie huge burdens on the backs of people and don't lift a finger to help
them.
Yeah,
this is, Ezekiel also talks about the false shepherds that were in charge of Israel for so long. And what were they doing? I mean, they were tearing them to pieces. They were not taking care of the sheep that they were supposed to be taking care of. This had been a persistent problem in Israel's history, is that leaders were kind of put in positions of authority and then they'd abuse the authority. In the case of the Pharisees, just like you said, I mean, they were loading up people with all sorts of impossible laws to keep. And of course, people are led to believe that because they're not keeping the law, that they're probably in danger of damnation.
Right. Yeah. And this is why the Pharisees were no shepherd, no kind of shepherd at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he says, so we read on, then he said to his disciples, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. Something I find interesting about this, in this passage, when Jesus looks on the crowd, they look harassed and helpless. They look, I mean, you know, like completely defeated. When Jesus sees that, acknowledging that they're completely defeated, he sees it as a plentiful harvest. Mm-hmm. Jesus is not looking for people that have an impressive resume of spiritual success and spiritual victory. Jesus sees a harvest when he sees broken, torn open, defeated sinners.
Right.
He says, that looks like a harvest field to me.
Right. And like, I think it's interesting that he says the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. And then it says, pray earnestly to the Lord of the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. So here we see that he's the Lord of the harvest. It's his harvest. And he's going to send some laborers out there to gather up his harvest, right? So it's not your harvest or my harvest. And we're not the Lord of the harvest. We don't go out there in our own wisdom and our own strength. No, it's his harvest. And he's the Lord of it. And then he sends out some laborers to go and gather up what needs to be gathered up, which also, and I do think that he is talking about, you know, pastors and evangelists, that sort of thing, right? And sure. He's talking about shepherds or sheep without a shepherd. He's like, we need some laborers here. And it also shows you then that a pastor is a servant. He's a laborer. He is not a king. He's not a monarch. He's a servant.
Yes. He's somebody that gets dirty with the sheep.
That's right.
There is no possible way of doing the job of a shepherd. Whether you're talking a literal shepherd in the field of sheep or a shepherd in the church without getting dirty, there is no way. Like, you get dirty if you're going to do that job.
Yeah, as my buddy Jared C. Wilson says, if you're a shepherd and you don't end each week with a little bit of dirt and wool on the jacket, you might not actually be a shepherd.
It's true. It's true, man. I mean, and if you're a shepherd and you know, and we see people like this, I mean, we see people like this that will carry the title of shepherd, but they're not in the trenches, you know, they're not getting dirty.
They ain't seen
it, or they stay away from it.
They ain't seen that. They haven't went out in that field a day in their life.
Yeah. And that's just not the job, man. It's, I mean, Mike Rowe really needs to do a Dirty Jobs episode on shepherds and pastors, because that's what it should be about.
I'm pretty sure that the harvest, the field is just my office, Eric.
Like, the harvest is a really big book.
Yeah, I can just like stay in my office. I can just like never go anywhere but my office and the church, and hey, pretty much harvesting.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Until you get that call in the middle of the night from some family that's blowing up in your church, and they're at their wits' end, and they say, "Pastor, can you help?" And you get up in the middle of the night, and you drive over to that family, and you probably don't know what you're doing, but you're getting your fingernails dirty.
Yeah, and
you're getting dirty.
Yeah, and it's even like, they're talking about like going out into the field. I mean, okay, look. The field is not the church.
Correct.
I mean, read the parables. The field is the world. That's what it
Ding.
Is. So I'm sorry, but like, you're going to have to mix it up in the world. Like, you are going to have to go out and mm-hmm. meet and mingle and rub up against people that are not in your church.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the gig, man. It's part of the deal. And like, I know that was a little bit of a pet peeve. It's irritating. When I see so much of yes, you have to shepherd the flock that is given you, but like we're also laborers in the field, and we are to like go out and talk and meet and love people who are not yet in the sheep pen of the church, that are just out there wandering around the field of the world.
Part of the gig. I mean, as Paul tells his you know, his young learner, his disciple Timothy, do the work of an evangelist.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of it, and you can't just say that that's Sunday morning, but it's part of your life. It's part of what it means to be a shepherd. So, and that's what Jesus does next in Matthew 10. He basically does the sending out. So he's about to send out his laborers, his apostles, into the harvest. And so, in verse 1, it says, and he called to him his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every disease and every affliction. So, given them the authority to do all the stuff that we've just seen him do. Mm-hmm. And then we have the names of the 12 apostles. First Simon, who was called Peter, and Andrew his brother, James the son of Zebedee, and John his brother, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew the tax collector. I love that Matthew, the writer of this gospel, wants you to know that he was the tax collector.
Mm-hmm.
James the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus, Simon the zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. I find it fascinating that the next passage you read, it says Jesus sent out the 12, instructing them. Here's just a little note before I get into that. Jesus sent Judas Iscariot out.
Yeah.
Jesus sent Judas out.
With power and authority.
Yes. Now, I mean, this doesn't fit fit the comfy categories that we want to make. Jesus shared the table with Judas the night he was arrested. Before he was betrayed by Judas, he was with Judas at the table. He washed Judas's feet.
Mm-hmm. Judas was sitting there when he said, "This is my body broken for you. This is the new covenant, my blood shed for the forgiveness of sins." He was there.
Yep.
Judas dunked that bread in the cup, bro.
This does not mean in any way that the Gospels are like, so Judas is great. Not at all. I mean, right there, Matthew says Judas betrayed Jesus, but it's just something fascinating about how Jesus operates here, that he sent him out. He sent him out, and he instructs them, go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Just a note, that's not because Jesus isn't interested in going after the Gentiles and the Samaritans. We see that plenty of times throughout his ministry, and indeed, in the book of Acts, the church will do that. But this is a specific mission to go to lost sheep of the house of Israel. and proclaim as you go, saying the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse lepers, cast out demons. Do all the stuff you've seen me do, boys. You receive without giving, give without pay, acquire no gold or silver or copper for your belts, no bag for your journey or two tunics or sandals or a staff, for the laborer deserves his food. And whatever town or village you enter, find out who is worthy in it and stay there until you depart. As you enter the house, greet it. And if the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it is not worthy, let your peace return to you. And if anyone will not receive you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet when you leave that house or town. Truly, I say to you, it will be more bearable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town.
Ooh. Real quick, one more point.
Yeah.
Because it popped in my head. You know what's fascinating mm-hmm. about that Judas thing? So Judas is out doing this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But as you were saying, like, it's interesting how Jesus treats Judas. In Judas' betrayal, when he comes to him in the garden,
mm-hmm.
and he goes up to him and kisses him,
mm-hmm.
Jesus says, friend, do quickly what you have come to do. Mm-hmm. Doesn't say jerk. Say, like, listen, hey, punk. Don't kiss me. It doesn't say like traitor, betrayer. Mm-hmm. No, he says friend. Just saying.
Yeah, it's actually pretty stunning to see. Here's the thing, you know, with all of his disciples, Jesus has to be incredibly patient with them. They all make big mistakes, make big blunders. I mean, right after that moment with Judas, Peter's like, all right, it's time to start cutting off some ears. It's time to start stabbing people.
Peter is either a really good shot with a sword or a really bad shot.
Right. He could have been aiming for that dude's head and got an ear.
I feel like it was for the head. Like, who's like, I'm going to cut that dude's ear off?
Yeah. Yeah, he's probably going for the dude's head.
He's a fisherman. He's a fisherman. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's ear.
Yeah. And Jesus isn't happy about that either, but... So, I mean, we don't have much time left, but going over the instructions he's given them, there's one thing that kind of sticks out to me here, or a couple things. Number one, in verse 9 and 10, he tells them, you know, don't acquire gold or silver or copper. And basically just ends up coming down at the end of verse 10 saying, listen, basically all you need is food. You know, the laborer deserves his food. Mm-hmm. But everything else, you don't get anything else. So is this a verse, Dan, saying that people that are in ministry, that are laboring in the harvest, should not be allowed to take any sort of salary or compensation?
No, but I think what's happening here is that, I mean, you're talking about radical, like they're going out there and doing like crazy healing and stuff like that, right? And they're doing evangelistic work. This isn't like some church that they're like put in charge of to be a pastor of and serve mm-hmm. that church. They're going out and they're healing tons of people and that sort of thing. And what Jesus doesn't want people to do is feel like they can purchase the evidences of the kingdom of God being among them. So, hey, my son is sick. I'll give you X amount of dollars if you heal him.
That's exactly right.
Essentially, what Jesus is doing here is like, don't go Benny Hinn this.
Yes. Man, we are dropping names, naming names today.
That's one which name. I have no problem naming that name.
I have no problem naming that name either. I think that's exactly right. I think he doesn't want anything to be confused here. And we see this with Simon Magus in the book of Acts, where he really does try, he tries to purchase these powers and he's condemned for it. I mean, he's rebuked harshly for it. By the church. And so I think that's exactly what's being referenced here. But then what about, I mean, so as you enter the house, greet it. And if the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it's not worthy, let your peace return to you. And if anyone will not receive you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet when you leave that house or town. What's that all about?
I think that we see some of this where Paul says that the blood of certain people are not on his hands, that sort of thing too. I think it does tell you that there's only so much that is incumbent upon you to do as the proclaimer. I mean, you can't save anyone. You can't make anyone believe. So if they greet you, then like bless the house, bless mm-hmm. the people there, be at peace with them, tell them they're at peace with God, you know, this sort of mm-hmm. thing. But if they don't and they reject you, it tells you that there comes a point where you can just be like, well, you know, because here's the thing. We'll be tempted to, like, be like, I'm just going to keep going and keep going. And that's fine. And, like, keep praying. And maybe you got someone you really want to be saved and they're not. And but I've had instances where I've decided that, like, that my time is trying to do that is probably over. And and I'm probably going to have to, like, go fall into a prayer role where I pray for that person. Mm-hmm. But if it's going to happen, it's probably going to be someone else.
Yeah.
You know?
I've had the exact same thing happen.
And I don't think that, and it's not me like shaking the dust off my feet being like, all right, bud. I don't think it's like that. This is more saying that, like, I think that it's, hey, you move on to the next thing. Or as Paul says, like, my hands are free of your blood. Like, I gave you the gospel. And at some point you move on and give someone else the gospel. And I think it's more like that. And you know, and he says that it'd be more bearable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town. Well, that's just saying that, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah was living in rampant wickedness and got judged for it, but that wasn't as if they had rejected the incarnate Christ.
Right. That's really what's going on here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I do think that you're right, Dan, that really what's being referenced is just, there's only so much time and there's only so much, so many hours in the day that we get to do this kind of work, especially they're on mission and they're trying to go to as many people as possible. So there are times where you have to make a decision that, like, I can't give any more time to this person. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're wishing condemnation on a person, that, as much as it means like, I hope somebody else does give them the gospel.
That's right. And but, you know what? We can't do give any more time to this podcast.
Yeah, we're done.
That's it. All right, guys. Hey, thanks for hanging out with us. We went a little long today. You get a little, like, a couple minutes bonus, but you know what? You're welcome. Hey, go over to iTunes, rate and review. You know, you can follow Christ Hold Fast or me and Eric on Facebook and Twitter. We're on there. Christ Hold Fast is on there. Check it out. Eric, thanks for hanging out, bud. We'll see you next week.
All right. Sounds good.